Leonard Leggio was born July 5th, 1933, in the Bronx in New York City, and blossomed to become one of the early leaders of the classical liberalism revival movement. Today, he is executive vice president of the Atlas Economic Research Foundation, a research professor at George Mason University Law School, distinguished senior scholar at the Institute for Humane Studies, and serves on the editorial board of the American Journal of Jurisprudence in the Law School at Notre Dame University. He is past president of the Mont Pelerin Society and the Philadelphia Society, has spent a lifetime exploring the impact of free market economies throughout history, and influences a global audience of scholars, students, and world leaders. In 2005, he met with longtime colleague John Blundell, director of the Institute of Economic Affairs in London and columnist for London's Daily Telegraph, at the Liberty Fund in Indianapolis, Indiana, for A Conversation with Leonard Leggio.
Leonard, let's start with some personal details. When and where were you born?
I was born July 5th, 1933, in the hospital Westchester Square in the Bronx.
Now, your father's family came from Sicily.
My father's grandmother, my great-grandmother, came about 1885 as a widow with five teenage children to New York, speaking Albanian, but it's really remarkable to think of a widow speaking Albanian coming to New York to try to start a new life for her children. My grandfather also had emigrated at that time when my great-grandmother came and met my grandmother in New York City and married. And he had, in Sicily, he was a bootmaker, and he became dissatisfied with the barter economy. In other words, he would make shoes and boots, and then he'd be paid at the harvest time in wheat or olive oil or wine. And he decided he wanted to be in a money economy. So he moved to New York and opened his shoemaking shop on 42nd Street in a down the stairs in a brownstone. And so he said if he was going to go to a money economy, he would be at the very center of it on 42nd Street. So, and then he met my grandmother and married. But my mother's family came about 1890 from Berlin, and my grandfather was opposed to conscription, and so he migrated in order to avoid the Prussian conscription. And my father was a bricklayer, journeyman bricklayer, who then went into became a supervisor, and then into construction business and real estate business.
What was it like for you growing up in the Bronx in the 1930s and 1940s?
In the 1930s, of course, it was we were very young, and in fact, spent a certain amount of time in Miami Beach. My father had gone at earlier times because he was interested. He saw Miami as a growth area and that people, he recommended people invest there. And at that time, there were nobody lived on Miami Beach when he went in the 1920s. And in fact, he said, well, you know, we should build hotels here and buy the beaches. People would go across the causeway from Miami City when they wanted to go to the beach. And people said, well, what are you going to do, eat the sand? No one wants to be here, and now there's, you know, 1,000 hotels. At a later point in the 30s, we then moved there for a number of years, and my father was in business there in Miami. So I started school there in North Beach Elementary School. I entered when the European War was just beginning, and so I was quite aware and very knowledgeable, in fact, that the only student in the class who was interested in discussing what was going on in Europe. And in fact, I remember the latter part of the Spanish Civil War because it was on the radio and there were reports, so it was something in my consciousness. And then when we returned to New York, my mother placed us in the local parish school. She then transferred us to a preparatory school, which was called All Hallows Institute.
Though Ligio's mother would enroll her son in Catholic grade school, he was exposed to other cultures as well.
First summer camp I went to was a Jewish summer camp, so the first religious services I attended were Friday night Sabbath services in the Camp Lincoln in New Jersey, and this would have been, well, when I was six, maybe five or six.
How important was religion, if at all, to the day-to-day Ligio family life?
Well, first of all, my father was indifferent in religion. He had no hostility and no interest and no involvement in it. My mother was Lutheran and was interested in religion, and she had a strong interest in education and in traditional education as opposed to John Dewey and progressive education. And she felt that in contrast to government schools with the progressive education, that Catholic schools had a traditional sense of education and discipline. One of the advantages is that Catholic schools are much more interested in history, and so it fitted me very well to be in an atmosphere with where historical studies were more valued than other places. The school was four blocks from Yankee Stadium, so it was, which always caused a bit of a problem, especially during the World Series, because my father had season reserve tickets for Friday night games, and so that meant we had game tickets for the World Series, which were played in the day at that time. And so the principal was always sort of puzzled that my father insisted we had to leave school at 1 to go to the World Series. It was sort of his view of what was most important to do.
You once told me that you became interested in public affairs, political ideas, at the age of 7 or 8, and when I expressed incredulity that a 7 or 8-year-old could have been interested in contemporary affairs, you explained to me that every night your father would sit down with you by the wireless, that you would listen to the 6 o'clock news, which apparently was very brief, but was then followed by quite lengthy commentaries.
They were from all kinds of points of view. In addition to that, there were the newspapers. New York at the time had about 9 newspapers, including several that were either communist or secret communist newspapers, which were not ones that we read. So we had all of these. But at the center of this is that my mother and father had totally different political views. So there was a lot of discussion going on in addition to that. My father was an Al Smith Democrat. He had become interested in politics when Al Smith was running for governor of New York, and when the Democratic Party stood for repeal of prohibition and for free trade. And then he then supported Roosevelt, who, as soon as Roosevelt came in, he arranged for the repeal of prohibition, which locked in a huge constituency for Roosevelt for the rest of his administration, including my father, and for free trade and other issues, whereas my mother was tended to be more inclined to be a Republican and also much more dubious about foreign entanglements.
So what were the really big issues between your parents?
Well, initially, whether the U.S. should enter the Second World War or not, that was a big issue. And then, the growth of controls, regulations, and even though my father was in business, he still felt, well, Roosevelt knew right what to do and went along, and my mother was dubious about these some of these things.
Ligio graduated from Georgetown University, where he studied history, political science, philosophy, and economics. Attended Columbia Law School for a time, evolved his studies further at Fordham University Graduate School, and followed with a postdoctorate fellowship in European Economic History at New York University, where he studied under Ludwig von Mises.
At the end of World War II, there was a great outpouring of pro-liberty books. There was, in 1943, Ayn Rand's The Fountainhead, Rose Wilder Lane's The Discovery of Freedom, There was Isabel Patterson's The God of the Machine. And then in 1944, there was Mises' Omnipotent Government, Hayek's The Road to Serfdom, John T. Flynn's As We Go Marching, all in 1944. How about Rose Wilder Lane's The Discovery of Freedom, Man's Struggle against Authority? Her chapter on the Golden Age of Islam is often cited as being very important and insightful.
Yes, it is. It's in the continuity of from the late 19th century, when American tourists visited southern Spain, Cordoba, Seville, and so they, Granada, they became fascinated by the beauty and then learned more about that medieval period when Islam was much superior to the West in science, in sanitation, in provision of water, in agriculture, irrigation, all sorts of things. But then it became a kind of romantic thing as a way of being negative about the West, which I don't think was the correct thing. They were sort of carried away. And, of course, it's a long past era that I believe Muslims should look back on to learn how to progress and modernize on the basis of their own great tradition in science, in philosophy, in logic, in optics, was all sorts of great contributions, and in law and interpretation. And the problem is that the four or five competing schools of law in Islam were gradually contained and stopped. Interpretation, which was the great value, really a common law sort of legal system of continual interpretation, refinement, improvement, was stopped and went back to sort of just a literal reading of the early text. And this was finalized after 1517, the Ottoman Empire conquered Syria and Iraq, Egypt, North Africa, and therefore controlled the whole Muslim universe, and therefore declared interpretation totally ended.
Rose Wilder Lane later worked very closely with Roger McBride, and you were a great admirer of his work.
On Electoral College.
What was his thesis?
Well, it was more to describe it and its origins and why it's a valuable part of the Constitution.
Our third female author of 1943 is Isabel Patterson, author of The God of the Machine. It's said that this book explains why Athens gave us philosophy, mathematics, literature, science, and so on, and why Sparta gave us a good nickname for a football team. Would you agree?
Yes, it's correct that Sparta was created its whole system on the basis of we might call primitive militarism. That is, everything should be the creation of warriors. Even the birth of warriors, the continued education, training of warriors, and that everything else was forbidden because it would be a distraction, supposedly, from that, including commerce, including economic activity. In other words, to live at a very primitive level.
Omnipotent Government by von Mises came out in 1944, and that was an important book at the time.
Yale University Press was his publisher of many of his books, Human Action, Socialism, Theory and History.
And about that time also, Hayek's Road to Serfdom?
Yes. It was bringing Austrian economics again to America. Austrian economics had come in the 1890s, up until the First World War, and even then, for instance, Van Sickle, who was the Rockefeller Foundation representative in Europe, thought so highly of Austrian economics, he kept working with Mises. He arranged for Hayek to come to New York for a year to study, and then go back to set up the institute dealing with business cycles.
And finally, in 1944, John T. Flynn's As We Go Marching. I mean, he was a great scourge of Roosevelt, wasn't he? And Roosevelt would get very angry about...
Yes.
And tell us about...
Well, Flynn was an economic journalist who had written in the 20s and 30s more or less against what he thought were corruptions of corporations and the whole issues that percolated at the time of the Depression. He was writing for the New Republic. He was their weekly economic columnist. And then when 1939-40 came and he was questioning the U.S. Roosevelt's policies of directly and surreptitiously involving the U.S. into wartime activities, he became critical of that, and so he was dropped by the New Republic, and which was pretty much under, I don't want to go into all the details, communist influence, just as Oswald Garrison Villard was dropped by the Nation. The Nation had been founded in 1865 as the successor to the Liberator, and it was the great classical liberal journal. If you were asking me about a book that was centrally important, it was not directly a history book. It was a book that dealt with methodology of history, and that was Human Action by Ludwig von Mises.
Do you think in some way all six of these great books grew out of the war?
I would say yes. The war intensified, I mean, with rationing, with increased regulation, with conscription, all of the things that the New Deal, doubts that were being raised by the New Deal now became much more solid, much more, and it looked like it would be institutionalized. This is what was hoped for by the New Deal. During the 30s, over time, people who were considered progressives became conservatives because they felt the Roosevelt administration went too far in domestic or in international activities that were violating the principles that they felt as progressives, as individualists, they stood for. That, for instance, their opposition to conscription in the First World War was what defined being a progressive, and therefore Roosevelt bringing conscription in 1940 violated that. None of these people had been with Wilson in the First World War of government controls, and they thought the controls would continue after the First World War, and instead Harding and Coolidge were elected, and they dismantled this. And the Republicans, the era of normal, the whole campaign of Harding, let's go back to pre-war normalcy. And this was what the American public wanted. So these guys all were out, but 1932 election brought them all back. And they then wanted to create that. And by then they had a new model. Roosevelt had the model of Mussolini in Italy. And these people were all terrifically influenced by what they thought fascism had achieved. So the New Deal then was to be modeled on a lot of what the fascists were doing. And that over time turned off the progressive people, especially progressive intellectuals, who were horrified by all of this. For instance, the Full Employment Act of 1945, passed after the 44 election, was to institutionalize Keynesianism in the United States, to have the Council of Foreign Relations to come up with planning and to provide whatever would be necessary government spending to have full employment, to not have the market providing employment. And of course, the unions totally supported this. And yet, in the 1946 election, they were defeated. The Republicans won. The Taft-Hartley law was put in. The whole wartime controls were rationing. Everything was dismantled. And this was the big counter-revolution, in a sense, by the to restore the Constitution as much as they could at that point by Robert Alfonso Taft and the other Republican leaders. I had, the end of 1951, become a member of Students for Taft. And one of the things we did was in February 1952, I had come to New York for the Washington's birthday weekend, and there was that night taping or live presentation TV of Author Meets the Critic, which was a weekly show dealing with books. And that night they were having Robert Alfonso Taft's and his book, Foreign Policy for Americans. And we, whatever number we were, six or eight, went to the studio and positioned ourselves around underneath the microphones so that during the discussions we could cry out to Middle America, God bless you, Senator Taft.
You're in the prep school. Joe Peden was in the same class as you, who went on to become a professor of history. There was Ralph Rako, who went on to become a professor of history. There was Bob Hessen, who became a professor and fellow at the Hoover Institution at Stanford. I just find it very interesting that there were these four young men in the Bronx in the very late 40s who all developed a great passion for liberty and became professors of history, and you knew each other.
Ralph Rako and George Reisman and others had were also in the Students for Taft. That's where I first met them. And then when Taft was defeated, Ralph and I had gone to help a Republican congressional candidate running against Franklin Roosevelt Jr. And the office wasn't open. We went to a Horn and Hardart cafeteria to have iced tea, and he confronted my thinking that Social Security was a legitimate way to deal with pensions, etc. And we began to discuss it, and he convinced me that this was coerced redistribution and that the market was a better way of dealing with these things. And then he then recommended I read Human Action. So then I went and read Human Action. Then we also went to visit Fee at that time, and I became acquainted with Leonard Reed and Paul D. Harper and the other people at Fee in that particular time. And also that second year of college was an economics course, and that we were using Kenneth Boulding's Economic Analysis, which is a very sound economics book, which reinforced what I was reading in Human Action. But Human Action has a major section on two areas of importance to me. One was on economic history, and one on methodology of social sciences. And so that very much paralleled what I was, my own work dealing in studying and reading in history.
You and your band of friends around New York discovered the newly founded, newly formed Foundation for Economic Education, FEE, very early on in Irvington-on-Hudson. Tell us about going up to FEE in those days.
Well, it was very welcoming to young people. We'd just go and sit and meet with some of the staff. We'd come away with publications, etc., because FEE at that time published a lot of publications. They were publishing in briefs, which were short pamphlets, and then longer ones on the tariff idea, on farming, the conscription idea.
So, Leonard, by 1955, you've graduated. You're attending the Mises Seminar back in New York. You're running up and down the Hudson Valley to FEE. You've chaired the first ever chapter of ISI. You've been involved in Students for Taft. Like I say, you're back in New York City. We have a photograph here of you taken in the August of 1955. Five young men, all very nicely dressed with short haircuts. From left to right, there's Ralph Rako, Murray Rothbard, George Reisman, Robert Hessen, and you. You're all aged 20-something. You're all going to go on to make great contributions to our understanding of liberty. Tell us about this little band of warriors. I assume Murray Rothbard was the...
Well, Murray was the center of it. He referred to it as the Circle Bastiat, and he admired Bastiat so much and thought that this was a very nice epaulette for our small group of people. And at that point, then, William F. Buckley decided to launch National Review.
Tell us about Leonard Reed. What was his big contribution?
Well, I think creating FEE and creating a center. I mean, when it was done was in 1946, before the Republican return, and so people, it was kind of a monastic center to be be as a last redoubt in order to then move forward and bring back the ideas, bring back America to American ideas.
While attending Columbia Law School, young Ligio founded a chapter of the Intercollegiate Society of Individualists, which soon attracted the attention of Columbia's administration.
I was at Columbia Law School and decided to try and start a ISI chapter at Columbia Law School. We invited Senator Molly Malone from Nevada to come to lecture. He was a good friend of Goldwater, who had just come into the 1953 into the Senate. So he was sort of an early Goldwater Republican. So we invited Molly Malone, and three of us were called in by the provost of Columbia University and told we shouldn't have a charter, we shouldn't have the speech, we shouldn't do any of that, that was not what Columbia University was, that wasn't the point of view of Columbia University. So we went ahead and had Senator Molly Malone, and had, you know, whatever, 40 students or something, hear him. And at the end of the term, each of us was told that we would not return.
Undeterred, Ligio entered graduate school at Fordham University, expanding his studies and the ideas of a newly emerging classical liberalism revival movement.
Going back to your own situation at this time, you'd worked very closely with Murray Rothbard, and indeed you are the co-author of Volumes 1 and 2.
Well, I'd say second author. I mean, Murray was a unique... I mean, the point of the whole project to write this multi-volume, four or five volumes on... which was supposed to be one volume on all of American history, but the more Murray studied American history, the more interested he became in it as in itself. And instead of doing a short, easily available work, he thought everything should... There's so much interesting and important and instructive material in history, it should be presented.
After our photograph of the five of you in August 1955, your little group were invited to join Ayn Rand's circle because of a letter that Murray Rothbard had written.
Murray Rothbard had known Ayn Rand. In any case, National Review in December 1957 published a book review of Atlas Shrugged. And was very, very hostile and viewed free market ideas as somehow totalitarian. And what it was an objection to her saying that there were truths.
Who was this by?
By Whittaker Chambers. The consequence was that Murray wrote a letter to National Review countering Whittaker Chambers. And Ayn Rand wrote to him a note to him saying, why don't you come and visit? If you have some friends, why don't they come? So we were invited and went to Ayn Rand's apartment.
What was she like as a person?
Well, she talked all the time, and she had something to say, so that was fine. These were at night, so we might end up at 2 or 3 in the morning. Now, I was doing graduate research every morning at the New York Public Library and getting up early and going down there. So I was not able to sustain myself. So I'd doze off, and this was viewed as not proper. And so then I was not invited back to the meetings, which was okay because I couldn't sustain these late night vigils. But also I had other discussions that showed that I was not in, you know, likely to be a follower of Ayn Rand.
About this time, in fact, in 1958, when you were in your mid-20s, you were invited to attend a meeting of the Mont Pelerin Society, the scholarly organization founded by Hayek some 11 years earlier in 1947, a meeting at Princeton. What impact did that Mont Pelerin meeting at Princeton have on you?
Well, I had a much better sense of the international dimensions of the classical liberal movement.
What important relationships have developed out of Mont Pelerin for you?
Oh, such interesting people. Henri Lepage, for example. Mm-hmm. Another person was Christian Vatrine. Then in 1980, at the Mount Pelerin meeting at Stanford, I met Leon Lowe.
So that from was, South Africa.
Yes. So that those are some examples of people.
Of early contacts. Then, of course, you served Mount Pelerin as its treasurer, as vice president, and between 2002 and 2004, you were indeed president of Mount Pelerin.
Yes.
And you gave, of course, in Salt Lake City your presidential address the retiring president, which was quite must have been a special moment for you.
Well, it was, but it was also challenging moment because I think we need to be much more alert to what will be the future of Mount Pelerin Society within the context of the future of the classical liberal movement, classical liberal ideas, classical liberal scholarship. My whole life has been a regression in the sense that I was interested in contemporary events and current events and then became interested in the First World War and then moved back and kept moving back and moving back into the Middle Ages as the source of the rise of the West.
Ed Fulner, president of the Heritage Foundation in Washington, D.C., explains the intellectual benefits of Ligio's all-encompassing curiosity.
Leonard's unique ability, really, is to put the ideas of liberty into an historic context that goes back not just to Adam Smith and the Scottish Enlightenment, but really goes back much more fundamentally to early Roman ideas and all the way up then through all of history.
Looking over your whole life's work, I think five major areas leap out at one. Firstly, the work that, if you like, grows out of Mises' theory in history and Hayek's Capitalism and Historians and Max Hartwell's work on the Industrial Revolution and your own work on France and its early industrialization. Why don't you tell us a bit about that?
Well, attending Mises' seminar at NYU on his manuscript on theory and history helped focus even more on some issues through then Hayek's editing of Capitalism and the Historians, a clear indication of a research program for classical liberalism in history, and that included economic history in particular. I myself had been working on French intellectual history regarding economic thought. If you read the journals in this period before, in the 1790s, there's lots on machinery and on introduction of machinery of new inventions. They were trying to develop, but sort of in the French way of doing it by sort of centralized way rather than freeing the entrepreneurs to come up with ideas. So that studying the economics, I became more aware of the economic history, as it were, of mechanization. And of course, all the mechanization in this period is water power. Steam, even though steam engine was developed, it was very hard to replicate, to redo in England, much less anywhere else, whether in England, in Belgium, in the Ruhr, in France, in New England. It was all water power. Textbooks just jumped to steam engines and miss the stages of this development. But in addition, that France was adopting all of these measures, mechanization that had been going on in England for textiles, for example, and if it even went ahead with the Jacquard loom, which is really a form of computerization 200 years before today. And then it struck me that after 1815, after Napoleon, a lot of this became delayed, that it's after 1815 that France starts to really fall behind at a point when England really gallops ahead, and that the special interests in the legislature, in the deputies, in France, kept all kinds of restrictions and tariffs and all of the special interests that satisfied all of the existing industrialists, but didn't make room for any of the new mechanization that England was developing. And at that, in fact, in 1814, when after Napoleon's first fall, J.B. Say was sent to England and went and examined all of the industrialization, and they came back. But legislature wouldn't accept his ideas about free trade, about deregulation, in order, and the special interests kept these and blocked. And it's after 1815 that France was falling behind and England moving ahead.
Now, you've also worked on the law merchant and private commercial law, and the work of Raymond de Ruva, and Léonie comes in there in Hayek.
Yes, de Ruva was from Antwerp originally. He was trained initially as an accountant, and he did a lot of work in the archives of medieval Florence. And then he came to America, and he taught at Boston College Graduate School. He had done particular work dealing with questions such as usury and how the medieval scholastics had dealt with the question of usury, and how as an accountant, he understood what was going on in the banks. He wrote books on the Medici banks and on other banking institutions, and which is that since the banking all dealt with different currencies, that the loans would be made, let's say, in 100 Florentine florins, and then it was to be repaid in 240 ducats. But the exchange rate then meant that if you looked at it, it included interest. But the interest was disguised by using two different currencies, and it was legitimate because you were doing different currencies. You were allowed to charge for the risk. They didn't understand time preference, they didn't understand risk, and therefore, if it was to be repaid in a different currency, there was a risk premium involved. So these were legitimate transactions in which interest actually occurred, but under a slight guise. And then there were other aspects of the trade, the forms of organization for partnerships, for investment in the cargo of a sea voyage to, let's say, to Alexandria. All of these things, there were a lot of information that he was able to present. And a lot of his work appeared into Joseph Schumpeter's History of Economic Analysis. He was very close to Schumpeter as he was to Mises. And therefore, there was a continuity then when I became interested in law and had studied legal institutions at Columbia. And the issue of the law merchant as a evolutionary common law coming out of actual practice, out of the practice of the merchants, and that the merchants created this law among themselves, accepted it, adopted it, and of course it appears in English legal history as the Pie Powder Courts. The Pie Powder Courts were the law merchant courts in England, and it's Pie Powder is derived from at that time, for many centuries, law activities in England were in Norman French. And so Pie Powder was a popular designation for pied poudre, for dusty feet. And these were dusty feet court, that they were courts that had to be held that night because the same merchants would not be in the same town maybe ever again if they were in dispute. And therefore, the Pie Powder Court was the court of instantaneous adjudication.
And more recently, you've been doing some new work on the religious foundations of property rights.
Yes, and that's by analyzing and presenting all of the different views regarding private property in the Hebrew tradition, in the ancient Greek and ancient Roman religious tradition, and then into the Germanic laws of the medieval laws, etc.
And this is an ongoing research project.
Yeah, Alejandro Chalfwin and I have co-authored a essay that appears in Enrico Colombato's book on the Companion to Property Rights, published by Edward Elgar in 2004.
So above all, it's your work really in French economic thought that is I think what people first think about you when they think about your scholarly contributions.
What I consider maybe the most important area of scholarship is the rise of the West, and the rise of the West and the is now even a more important issue for debating and to understand why only in Europe has prosperity developed, has economic growth developed, and along with it important scientific development. The great fortuitous development for Europe was the Roman Empire collapsed in the West, and the West was the more underdeveloped part of the Roman Empire. But the West had the success of the collapse of the Roman Empire. The West is an open, unscripted society and based on a less developed, you might say, legal code. And indeed, England benefited even more because the Romans left England, so that there wasn't anything Roman in England when the Angles and Saxons and Jutes arrived. This was unadulterated early law rather than a constricted imperial law. It was more of a social law than a political law. And second, England had the benefit of the Danish invasions and the Dane law, so that was an even more primitive social rather than political legal system. So it created an England. The common law then evolves out of the most unpolitical and unstructured legal system, and therefore England had even more advantages than other parts of Europe. And Europe was very much divided into so many different subsets. Even Germany, the Holy Roman Empire, had hundreds of independent sovereign entities. Now, you could say that these could have been a barrier to economic development, where they were the opposite, because people could move. And this is the whole concept of voice and exit. There was no empire, there was no imperial system, there was no European-wide system to control you, and therefore you had competition between the different entities. So this is part of the rise of the West, is the competitive system, the lack of an imperial or an overriding governmental control, and with it then low taxes, low interference with trade.
So, Leonard, where does capitalism come into all of this?
It's in the High Middle Ages that you find capitalism, in particular in the monasteries, and in particular the Cistercian monasteries. The Cistercians wanted plainness, so they were kind of sort of like the Shakers. They built beautifully plain monasteries and churches. But to be as plain as possible, they wanted to not settle in good agricultural area where the Benedictines were. The Benedictines brought in the idea that labor is noble. Their motto was to work is to pray. And this was a big break from the ancient world. Cistercians wanted to work also, but they wanted to work have less income, in a sense. They went to places in the mountains, in the forests, in the swamps, etc. For instance, in England, they went into sheep rearing in the less hospitable places, but those turned out to have even more moisture and therefore better fleece than other places, so that by the end of the Middle Ages, the Cistercians were the richest order in Europe because they had sheep raising and wool production was the most important part of medieval economy and base of the textile industry. So they, were organized as a firm, each of the monasteries, and they had large number of people under their direction. They had other ranches, etc. And so they developed all of the necessary aspects that Weber thinks is involved in capitalism already much earlier, including better bookkeeping, better long-term investment, records of breeding, and therefore better animal husbandry, what feed to give and all of that, so that these would be the best product in their work. Now, I need to conclude by mentioning the important contributions in the area of the rise of the West, and that would be books such as E.L. Jones on the European Miracle, or Jean Béchelaire on the rise of capitalism. There's Rosenberg and Bertzel's book on why the West grew rich. There is a very, very important book by Harold Berman called Law and Revolution on the legal revolution in Europe. And drawing on that is Deepak Lal's book Unintended Consequences, which explains some of the further elaborates the economic implications of the legal revolution.
I think throughout this interview you've time and again shown us why history is so crucial to liberty. How can we improve on the understanding of that history brings?
I don't know. The movement in the last decades, 30, 40 years, has been towards simplistic textbooks. Herbert Butterfield had written a lot on the problem of textbooks, but I think they're necessary. But Butterfield points that the textbook abridges, and he's talking about before the real barbarians and vandals have taken over our textbooks. And so everything is cut out. My friend Joseph Peden edited several textbooks, and they were required to remove anything dealing with religion from European history, from medieval European history, because somehow therefore religion is controversial. So then if the textbooks then are made, you're made by a committee, but the committee is all agreeing on premises, so that, and the whole idea is that the earlier textbooks, which were terrific, have to be wrong, and we're going to put in new textbooks, but that means dropping all the valuable information in the pre-existing ones, schemas to help the student. So the whole approach to doing textbooks is to, in a way, replicate television. Now, I think television programs on history are excellent, and if you think of Sir Kenneth Clark, Civilization, or any others, even Michael Wood, they're all terrific and worth seeing, but that's not the same as a textbook. And maybe you want different textbooks for different kind of students, but we have such a homogenized system. In other words, a textbook for a high school for Texas, one book is chosen for all the students in Texas, or in California, or New York, because they're not supposed to be students who are better than other students in different schools, but they are, and it would be sensible to have students who are capable of understanding a book better, having a more demanding book. So I just fear that there's even where people study history, they don't learn any history.
Again, Ed Fulner comments.
He doesn't talk in sound bites, and but when he talks, it's a fully formed notion that just intrigues you because he is able to tie so many different strands together. And that's been his unique contribution, I think, really, to so much of the preserving the ideas that we believe in and making them relevant, really, to future generations.
Henry Hazlitt. Tell us about Henry.
He's a very fine man, very, very thoughtful. Here is a man who started out, and as a young man, he learned shorthand. He became an executive secretary to various newspaper editors and people like that, and at the same time taught himself economics and became then an economic writer for The Nation magazine. And then eventually became the financial editor for the New York Times and continued that until 1945, when, after a very fine career, including his reviews, even in the 30s, of Mises Socialism, which was published by Jonathan Cape in London, and then by his review of Human Action and of Hayek and things of that sort. And he then went to work for the Newsweek magazine and had his column there, which was an extremely valuable column. They replaced him with Milton Friedman. So that was a lucky development, and then Milton Friedman then had such an important impact through his Newsweek columns. And in a way, his success as a Newsweek columnist led the way to the idea for Free to Choose to reach a wide audience through a TV series on economics.
You also knew Felix Morley. I mean, you told us earlier that you used to listen to those news commentaries as a very young boy.
He was when I first heard of him, he was broadcasting. There was a 15-minute program that he and Ray Henley presented, and Felix Morley wrote a book on the League of Nations and received his PhD from Brookings. So Brookings was more like a Oxford or Cambridge as a graduate school. And then he became the editor of the Washington Post and was made that a very successful newspaper and won the Pulitzer Prize for his editorials, which were critical of the New Deal. I did an obituary and I called him a Commonwealth man, given his connections with Sir Ernest Barker and his own research and writing dealing with the Commonwealth period in England and the levelers, and that his ideas really were represented a 17th century classical liberalism as it was emerging.
Moving on, you've always had a great admiration for Bruno Leone.
Leone was someone who made himself evident to Hayek, you might say. He was a professor at the University of Pavia. He was a legal theorist and entered into the Mount Pelerin Society and presented ideas that may have been unconsciously percolating in Hayek's mind as he was completing the Constitution of Liberty. So this would have been in the second half of the 1950s. Hayek had already presented some major aspects of Constitution of Liberty in Cairo. He gave a series of lectures for the Bank of Egypt in Cairo, and those were published in 1954 by the Bank of Egypt under the title The Rule of Law. And they then appeared as several different chapters in the Constitution of Liberty. And I want to emphasize, Constitution of Liberty is doubly valuable. people should study the footnotes. They should read all the books that Hayek refers to in the footnotes. That's an incredible resource, is the footnotes. That tells you really classical liberalism's development and its richness. Bruno Leone clarified the value of common law and that it's a representation of spontaneous order, and that law itself is more valuable if it's a spontaneous order, if it evolves and able to adjust to reality and not try to be constructivist. That civil law, Justinian's code, is constructivist. And as I learned from Richard Epstein, who gave courses for us for the Institute for Humane Studies, that classical Roman law was common law. It was evolutionary. It was a judge-made law. The praetors' decisions were based on previous decisions. It's only when Justinian, thinking that the world was collapsing around him and the Roman Empire was collapsing, and it only lived another 900 years in Byzantium, but nevertheless, he threw out that whole, everything that made Roman law great and contained it into this constructivist format, and even destroyed all the existing books and declared interpretation bad, which was then followed by the Ottomans in 1517. They declared interpretation bad. So these despotic regimes are totally against evolution. Why everyone appreciates the English common law system and other aspects of the political framework, because it's not constructivist, it does not outlaw evolution and growth and learning. That's what law is, a learning process, and the decisions are results of learning and therefore improving.
Great giant in the rebirth of classical liberalism, of course, has been Milton Friedman.
The unique thing about Milton Friedman, beyond his brilliant scholarship, was his dedication to classical liberalism, and his viewing himself and displaying himself as a classical liberal, and making himself a model for other scholars to apply their narrower economic contributions to a much wider contribution to society, to benefit society.
Also out of Chicago, of course, Gary Becker, George Stigler, Ronald Coase, all Nobel laureates that you've interacted with.
Yes, I have. All have made terrific contributions, especially Coase, because he represents a part of the London School of Economics tradition. And I think that's an important tradition that needs to be recognized and understood as a separate and valuable part, very much parallel to Austrian School of Economics. Edwin Cannon was the founder of that London School of Economics. He was himself an economic historian, but taught a number of people who continued on in a tradition that was very much parallel to Austrian economics. Coase, of course, was one. Bill Hutt, who went to Cape Town, and then to University of Dallas. But there were others who were in that tradition, dealing with property rights and dealing with markets. And Arthur Seldon, in some ways, viewed himself as the last person to have been in that tradition there at the London School of Economics, the tradition of Edwin Cannon, and then of Lionel Robbins.
And Plant.
And Plant, also Sir Raymond Plant, who was went to be dean of the School of Commerce at the University of Cape Town. So there it was it's a very important and rich tradition, and not always noted and touched upon. So Coase gives us an opportunity to see that.
And Selden, of course, who was the next person I was going to ask you about, actually, then continued that work very much at the Institute of Economic Affairs.
Yes, and here was someone, again, a brilliant mind, who put it to the role of editor and mentor, and who created, through his editing, great works that might otherwise not have had the impact that they had.
You mentioned the LSE tradition as being separate from Chicago and public choice and so on, but you've also possibly been most associated yourself with encouraging young scholars more in the Austrian tradition.
Well, definitely. I was a student of Ludwig von Mises and then in a way of Hayek, and worked very closely with Murray Rothbard, very much admired the work of Israel Kirzner, among many, many other Austrian economists. And through the Institute for Humane Studies, I tried to encourage much younger scholars who were beginning to work in that area and had an interest in developing the market ideas that originally Karl Menger, and then Mises, Hayek, and then the Kirzner and Rothbard had been developing.
The Institute for Humane Studies, of course, took a strategic decision in 1974 to try to resurrect Austrian economics, and started a whole series of conferences from South Royalton, Vermont.
It was also a strategic unintended consequence that in June 1974, the first of these new Austrian economics programs was undertaken at South Royalton, Vermont. And then in October, Hayek won the Nobel Prize for Economics. And that was an incredible development. It also revived Hayek's own interests and work in his writings and his new research areas of interest at an advanced age, but also brought about a greater recognition and renewed focus on Austrian economics. And I can recall in the spring of 1975, Hayek then was invited by the Liberty Fund to come to the U.S., and I was asked by the Liberty Fund to greet him at the JFK airport.
Anthony Fisher. You knew Anthony.
He began the Atlas Economic Research Foundation, and he settled in San Francisco.
Sounds like the Volcker Fund was a precursor to the Liberty Fund.
Well, it's many... a lot of, and it was made. It was very well known by Pierre F. Goodrich.
Now, the Volcker Fund did this amazing work in the late 50s and very early 60s, but then in 1962 it expired. I mean, what was the story there?
Well, Mr. Luneau, who had gotten older, just decided that he didn't want to continue what was going on. And just previous to that, he had authorized the F.A. Harper to start the Institute for Humane Studies.
Why did the Institute for Humane Studies start at Wabash College? And what was the role of Pierre Goodrich?
Well, Mr. Goodrich had been very interested. He had just founded in 1960 the Liberty Fund. And he was very interested in, and knew Baldy Harper quite well, and was interested in this idea of the Institute for Humane Studies. So he became vice president when it was incorporated. And when then the Volcker Fund was dissolving, he invited Harper to become visiting professor at Wabash College, where Mr. Goodrich was chairman of the board. Pierre Goodrich would have liked the Institute to remain at Crawfordsville at Wabash College, where he was so involved, but Baldy felt that the idea of getting research scholars to come there rather than to Palo Alto was not going to work.
So it's quite a lot of churn. I mean, in 1960, Liberty Fund being created, 61, IHS being created, 62, Volcker Fund expiring, and then after a year at Wabash, IHS moving up to Palo Alto. It was quite a
When Waldy moved back, as is famously known, he started the Institute for Humane Studies in his garage. In some ways, you could say my whole career has been an attempt, even though it was closed down in 62, to recreate all of the things that the Polka Fund was doing, even though we didn't have the funds to do that. There was no endowment. There was just me trying to put things together and keep things moving in that direction.
Changing tack slightly, you became a Knight of Malta. Perhaps you could explain to the viewers what that...
Well, the Knights of Malta were created in the year 1099 in Jerusalem after the siege of Jerusalem. During the siege, the Crusaders were themselves besieged by another force, so they were between two hostile forces, and there was a Provençal man named Brother Gerard, and he reputedly every night threw bread over the wall to the Crusaders, and so when they finally entered into the city, they wanted to reward him, and he then created this group of nursing brothers. Because pilgrims were attacked on the road from the Mediterranean to Jerusalem, they also began to defend and send out convoys to escort them, and they became knights. And so they were knights and monks at the same time. And then it relocated to the island of Rhodes, and then finally to the island of Malta. But Napoleon, on his way to Egypt in 1798, expelled the knights from Malta, and they then settled in Italy. And now it's entirely a charitable organization, mainly conducting hospitals and ambulance services and ambulance trains in conflict situations.
You've also served twice as president of the Philadelphia Society.
Yes.
Why don't you tell us a little bit about the Society and its work?
Well, the Society was founded in 1964 and is viewed as an American version of the Mount Pelerin Society, and in fact was founded by Mount Pelerin founders such as F.A. Hayek and Milton Friedman. And It tends to have more of aspects that Hayek wanted to see in the Mount Pelerin Society, but which tended to not be so evident, and that is history and philosophy, and even literature.
What would you say is the, if you had to name a single high point in your career?
I'd say to be elected president of the Mount Pelerin Society. I think that seemed to bring together all the different elements, the great scholarly contributions of MPS and the international contributions that it makes.
Any, at the other end of the spectrum, any low point?
I think the dissolution of the Volcker Fund. I feel that was a low point. It was not dramatically affect me, moved on, but it affected the movement. There was a huge amount of resources totally deflected away from from classical liberalism, and classical liberalism took a long time to recover.
In 1985, you were part of the team that moved the Institute for Humane Studies from Menlo Park, California, to affiliate with George Mason University in Fairfax, Virginia.
Yes, but it was a situation where it was George Mason University, the president and vice president, who were anxious for IHS to affiliate. IHS, in a sense, was older than George Mason University, and brought a certain amount of new distinction to the university.
Well, after 20 years now at George Mason, you've been a professor throughout that period, teaching, I recall, from 85 to 1990, European economic history and European diplomatic history. And then since 1990 at George Mason University Law School, teaching the history of legal institutions. Yes. Soon after getting to George Mason, you invested a great deal of time in pretty much ensuring that Henry Manet would be named dean of the law school and would bring with him the Law and Economics Center.
Yes.
How did that all...
Well, it was actually wonderful. The law school was just beginning to be in a position to take off, and the university then was looking for someone to bring a dynamism, not just to administer the existing, actually low level of the school, but to move it up many, many notches. Today, it's about ranked 38th, I think, in the United States.
Since, well, really over this past 20 years, since IHS relocated to George Mason University, that you've been the distinguished senior scholar at IHS, research professor at George Mason University, executive vice president of the Atlas Economic Research Foundation. It was really quite an explosion of activity there. I mean, you already had at George Mason people like Richard Fink and Don Lavoie and Jack High in the Center for Study of Market Processes. The Center for Study of Public Choice arrives in 83. IHS arrives in 85, the summer of 86, Henry Manet and the Law and Economics Center arrive. In October of 86, Buchanan gets the Nobel Prize. I mean, George Mason exploded with activity. And
because the administration was open, was not hidebound, was not trapped in way things had been done, which was not to do anything. The very incredible inertia of American universities, that the then president of the university, George Johnson, wanted to have a university in his own tenure that moved fast, and the way to do that was to bring pre-existing valuable scholarly entities into association for whatever reasons. And these were people underappreciated where they were and would add value to George Mason University by being, because they were such great scholars, though undervalued. And so this has been a repeated situation at George Mason.
And of course they attracted the group from Arizona.
Yes, an experimental economics, and that was rewarded when Vernon Smith in October 2002 won the Nobel Prize in Economic Science. So George Mason now has two Nobel Prize winning economists on the faculty.
Well, you say it has two. Many people think it should be three, and that Gordon Tullock,
yes,
who's a great friend of yours and a great collaborator with Jim Buchanan.
Yes.
Before long, he'll be the third George
That's
Mason.
Another.
Tell us about Tullock.
Well, Tullock is Tullock. He's a unique individual. He happens to have the office across from mine in the George Mason Law School.
Many people are tipping him to win the Nobel Prize in Economics, and he doesn't have an economics degree. He was a diplomat. He served in China. Yes. I believe his education is mostly in legal studies.
And he has no graduate degree.
I recall one story about him that when that caused a furore at the University of Virginia, when sitting there in the economics department, he single-handedly out-published the political studies department in political studies journals one year.
He's very productive, very thoughtful.
Could you give us your assessment, given your great knowledge of European history, your quick assessment of the project in Europe for ever closer union, as the 1957 Treaty of Rome calls it?
Yes. Well, 1957 Treaty of Rome was organized by Foreign Minister Martino, the father of the present defense minister. And it put forward the desire for a European free trade zone, customs union, I'd say. It may have been unfortunate that it came out of the European Steel and Iron community, in that that itself was an attempt to deal with, in a bureaucratic way, rather than in a market way, with the what they thought was overcapacity about steel and iron, etc. And it also came out of the Marshall Plan, which helped to revive Europe, but also may have introduced, may have kept structures there that were political rather than market structures. In any case, but once they had done that, they then went off into this creating of a bureaucracy. You didn't need a bureaucracy to end customs between, you just ended customs, and that's all they needed. The next thing you know, all kinds of new jobs were created, and plus all kinds of special interests, and ending up with oceans of olive oil and seas of wine in storage. In
mountains of butter.
Mountains of butter. So I think, you know, there's a great deal of unthinking dogma in the whole European, and it's all gone in the wrong direction.
Moving into 1960, I know you've often talked to me about Nixon and Kennedy, about
yes,
that election.
A very close contest, and probably was stolen by Mayor Daley in Chicago, giving Kennedy the very narrowest of victory. But I, for instance, I listened to the debates of Kennedy and Nixon.
The candidates need no introduction. The Republican candidate, Vice President Richard M. Nixon, and the Democratic candidate, Senator John F. Kennedy.
And I thought Nixon had won all the way down. Everything he said made much more sense.
Here again, may I indicate that Senator Kennedy and I are not in disagreement as to the aim. We both want to help the old people. We want to see that they do have adequate medical care.
I think Mr. Nixon is an effective leader of his party. I hope he would grant me the same. The question before us is, which point of view and which party do we want to lead the United States?
Mr. Nixon, would you like to comment on that statement?
I have no comment.
But I didn't watch it on television, and apparently people who watched it on television felt that people looked differently and voted in terms of how they looked and not in terms of their arguments.
And then, of course, there was the famous Goldwater Johnson election of 1964.
Yes, and Goldwater made some very fine speeches, but people, certainly the press, had no sympathy and totally dismissed and ridiculed his campaign. There was the famous last week, the Ronald Reagan television appeal for support, which gained a lot of attention both for Reagan and for as well as Goldwater. But the Goldwater campaign had a lot of good ideas, but they had not been enough preparation to for public to pay attention or understand them. And then once Johnson gained election, he went off into the Vietnam War, and at the same time into the Great Society. I think he was one of the worst presidents we ever had, most destructive, and we're still suffering from consequences of the Johnson administration in a lot of ways.
Was there much opposition to his ideas about the Great Society?
Yes, of course. Goldwater was opposed to it, and a lot of Republicans were opposed to it, but no one listened to them.
It was overshadowed by the war, right? I mean, the war was...
Yeah, but also by let's do wonderful things, let's help people, but, you know, turned out to be worse for the people that were supposed to be helped. It's unintended consequences or something, which then created a whole recognition. It's at that point that the arguments and the articles in Newsweek by Milton Friedman began to sink into people, that there are unintended consequences. The minimum wage creates black youth unemployment, that the welfare measures may give people money now, but it means then they will never be employed. It means a permanent, you know, trying to help somebody for a day actually condemns them to a terrible life of the lifetime.
In 68, Nixon defeated Humphrey, and in 72, Nixon again, and that time defeating McGovern.
Yes.
What stands out for you from those
two
elections?
Well, that Nixon was so enmeshed about Vietnam, one, the most important, you might say, good thing he did, which was inspired by Milton Friedman, was he abolished conscription. And this was a huge plus. It certainly was strongly welcomed by his base in the Republican Party, as well as a lot of independents, and it very much enhanced his 1972 candidacy.
In 1984, President Reagan defeating Mondale. Any particular?
No, it just was very gratifying to have Ronald Reagan reelected, given his strong pro-liberty philosophy.
92, though, going down in flames to...
92 election was, and 96 was very unique in that there was a third party candidate, Ross Perot, and Ross Perot was campaigning on limiting the budget and containing spending to have a budget control, and appealed to a lot of people who otherwise might have voted Republican. So it was a big deflection of possible support for the first President Bush. So Ross Perot got a huge vote, and that was all deducted from likely Republican voters. So Bill Clinton was the beneficiary of this. In the second campaign, Ross Perot ran again. He got somewhat less votes, but he was running against Senator Dole, who had never really been a clear budget container and therefore wasn't able to win back the voters again who were still voting for the idea of budget containment. And meanwhile, Bill Clinton had rather good, especially then in the second term with Robert Rubin as Treasury Secretary, very thoughtful economic advisors, and was able to attract people away from the Republicans on that issue.
It's interesting, isn't it, how the Democrats in the United States and, say, New Labour in Britain have learnt the importance of having good people in charge of the Treasury or the economics jobs.
Yes, except, for instance, Al Gore deviated from Clinton's policies in his campaign and campaigned on a populist vote, which would have lost him the Democrats who supported Clinton, and they went for George W. Bush. So Bill Clinton had learned that, but even Gore decided to go off in a populist direction, which frightened people about his potential economic policies, and in such a close election, he was defeated.
If you can do this, I know it's very hard, but in one line, in one sentence, what do you think they'll say the Liggio legacy is?
Well, the preservation of classical liberalism. I hope that will be.
And preservation and development, maybe?
Well, at this point, sometimes I feel a little uncertain of the educational system, and other things seem to not be encouraging for people to know what's made success that they enjoy, and instead they enjoy it without knowing how it came about. Or as Santayana said, if you don't study history, you're condemned to repeat its failures. So I think there's unfortunately a lot in American public life, not to mention in Europe and other countries, where people are going to be condemned to repeat their failures.
Milton Friedman claims we're less free now than when he was born. Do you share that?
Yes. Yes, we have. I mean, when you see the amount of regulations being produced by the Federal Registry alone is an example of that. I'm certainly not more free intellectually than I was. I mean, the possibilities of even press restrictions may not be avoided. I fear. I mean, there's a movement towards more regulation in various ways. We certainly see it in the economic sphere, and so there's a total regulation. I don't see any more free, you know, I'm not more free intellectually, but I fear we may be less free intellectually in the future. So I think the whole trend is a kind of dark age. I mean, a dark age in which there's huge amount of media, but you know, what does it mean? It's just lots of, it's like a you know, a fear of the future of, you know, all kinds of nice scientific developments, but it's all soulless and pointless.
Where would you say the freedom debate is at its most intense now?
I fear there's not enough debate. There's not enough, there's a lot of coasting and a lot of inertia. And I don't see, certainly there isn't much in the universities and academia. It's just less and less. They're not, there's no interest in liberty in the universities. They don't know what it is. They're just doing, just fulfilling their jobs. I mean, next to incredible advances in science, those are wonderful. Everything in science is wonderful. And yet they've been allowed a lot of freedom that, they have freedom that isn't existing in the humanities and social sciences, and where there's a real censorship, informal censorship.
Again, Ed Fulner comments on Leonard Leggio.
He is now really the unique person, not only in the American conservative movement, but really around the world, to pull the strands together in the history of ideas, and particularly the idea of liberty.
To you, what is the very essence, the very heart of liberty?
The pursuit of one's ideals, the pursuit of ideals, and those can be in the material as well as in the intellectual, spiritual areas, and the ideals of an entrepreneur, the discovery of something that's missing that he wants to introduce and to test and to hope for success. So I think it's the constant alertness to new ideas and the ability, not the physical ability, but the lack of coercion and restraint on you to do what would be helpful to mankind.
So it's not about wealth creation.
Wealth creation is the obvious consequence of liberty. It's in other words, it's the result of people being free to pursue their visions.
One of the many photographs of you in this little book, Born on the 5th of July, is of you meeting the Pope John Paul II.
Yes, it was one of several conferences that I attended in the Vatican. And in fact, staying in the same residence where the cardinals stayed when the recent conclave. And I was just in Rome with Father Sirico for another Vatican conference, which related to these issues.
So there's quite a network of people in that particular part of your life that you've influenced,
yes,
who in turn have influenced matters in the Vatican.
Yes.
I believe you've played a great role in the development of the Acton Institute. It does outreach to...
Well, it does mainly, first of all, to seminarians of all religious groups, but especially Christian religious groups, Catholic and Protestant, and then works with other, for instance, lay leaders in the various denominations. Retreats and seminars, lectures, so it's and publications. They publish a journal, Morality, on morality and liberty and...
And the market economy.
And the market economy, yes.
And you've served on the board there?
I had, yes, for about 10 years, yes.
Leonard, when you turned 65 some 7 years ago, over 100 of your friends around the world, from 16 different countries, in fact, wrote letters on the occasion of your birthday, and they were published as a little book called, appropriately enough, Born on the 5th of July. And on the back cover, the publisher writes, F.A. Hayek was recently described as the great architect of the revival of classical liberal ideas. If Hayek is the great architect, then Leonard is surely the great builder, building a worldwide movement one life at a time. Or perhaps one career at a time is a more apt description of his modus operandi. So a very, very nice paragraph.
I appreciate it because it does capture a lot of the work that I've been involved in, and in particular in terms of one career at a time, having the opportunity to mentor and advise young people, especially in their academic and scholarly work, and in addition to that, in public policy research areas, to progress, to choose more profitable, from a non-monetary point of view, direction for their work.
In fact, reading from the preface here, there are 129 letters signed by 154 people, and the 16 countries they come from are Argentina, Australia, Brazil, Ethiopia, France, Germany, Guatemala, Iceland, Italy, Mexico, the Netherlands, Puerto Rico, Russia, Sweden, the United Kingdom, and the United States. So that's a pretty fair spread.
It is.
It shows the international aspect,
yes,
of your life.
There's nothing I enjoy more than watching Leonard with a crowd of 50 undergraduates and just seeing their minds open up as he talks to them about ideas going back to Grotius or well before Adam Smith, and then tracing it down. And he does this, of course, not only here at George Mason University. He does it with his regular summer course in the south of France, with his regular professorship down at the University Francisco Marroquin in Guatemala, and on and on and on, all over the world, really. Whether it's in Sri Lanka or Malaysia or Nigeria, Leonard's always there, and he's always willing to talk and to listen and to make the theory applicable to a local situation. To be with Leonard at a meeting of the Mont Pelerin Society in Madrid or in Cancun, and to have him talk about the Spanish influence on the tradition of liberty is probably only surpassed by being with him in Reykjavik and having him talk about the Norse tradition of liberty or the Hanseatic tradition when we were in Hamburg not so long ago. He understands it and he knows it so well.
Leonard, this has been wonderful. It's been absolutely fascinating. Thank you so much indeed for sharing your experiences and your wisdom with us. Thank you.
Thank you very much, John, for your insights.
Leonard Leggio, scholar, teacher, mentor, and one of the early leaders of the classical liberalism revival movement. His research, teaching, and writings have influenced educators, students, international leaders, and liberty-minded individuals and institutions worldwide. This has been A Conversation with Leonard Leggio. A production of The Liberty Fund. For further information on related series programs or subjects, visit libertyfund.org.